Kia ora, and welcome to Amran's Podcast, episode 173. Today is Thursday, September 3rd, 2009. Well, I've got a lot to go over today, because it's been nearly 2 weeks since I've done an Amran's Podcast. Now, of course, you know why I was busy last week. Well, this week I'm also busy, but for work reasons. In fact, I'm so busy that I really shouldn't be taking the time to record now. But I wanted to be able to record and post something before the Labor Day holiday weekend in the U.S., for the convenience of my U.S. listeners. And if I don't do it today, it's not going to happen. So here we are. Now today I'm going to tell you about our trip to Northland, as you'd expect. I'm also going to tell you sort of the final things about the smacking referendum that I've talked about the past couple of episodes. I have a bunch of comments and emails and stuff. But first, today is, of course, September 3rd, which marks the actual declaration of World War II, the 70th anniversary of the declaration of World War II. Officially, New Zealand's declaration was simultaneous with Britain's, and it was supposed to have started from the expiry of the British government's ultimatum to Germany to withdraw from Poland, which was 9:30 p.m. New Zealand time. It's 11 a.m. British time or thereabouts back then. But they waited to get formal advice from the British government to make sure that it had actually gone through before they settled it. And then at 11:30 p.m. New Zealand time, the acting Prime Minister, Peter Fraser, issued a statement that was confirming that New Zealand was at war. And this is what it said in part. "This is not an occasion for many words. It is a dark day in the history of the world. It is with deep regret and sadness that I make this announcement on behalf of the government, and the people will receive it with similar feelings. That will not, however, affect the determination of both government and people to play their part." Now, of course, the thing is that at that time, New Zealand was not fully independent, you might say, because the British Nationality Act, Statute of Westminster, wouldn't be passed until 1948. So technically, New Zealand was still a dominion of the United Kingdom. But it was self-governing. It was largely independent. It was in many ways independent in all but fact, or maybe all but name, I guess you'd say. And so that's what was sort of behind the scenes there. Now, the Governor General was still a member of the British peerage at that time. The Governor General was Viscount Galway, whatever, who cabled the Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs to advise that the existence of state of war with Germany has accordingly been proclaimed in New Zealand. The proclamation and Fraser's statement were reported in the newspapers the next day. Now, you might have heard me say that he was the acting prime minister, because the real prime minister at the time was a man by the name of Michael Joseph Savage, who was probably one of the two most beloved prime ministers in New Zealand's history. The other was a man in the 1970s by the name of Norman Kirk. Both of them were Labour prime ministers, and both of them, unfortunately, died in office. At the time that war was declared, Michael Joseph Savage was being treated for colon cancer, and it would ultimately claim his life some 6 months later. So that's why Peter Fraser was left to actually make the declaration of war. But 2 days later, Michael Joseph Savage did address the nation by radio, because that's all there was, of course, in 1939. And it's that phrase, that speech, which is now most associated with the declaration of war in New Zealand. And I wish I had an audio clip of that. I couldn't find one easily. But I'll just take a couple of minutes and read the relevant passage. He said, "I am satisfied that nowhere will the issue be more clearly understood than in New Zealand, where, for almost a century, behind the sure shield of Britain, we have enjoyed and cherished freedom and self-government. Both with gratitude for the past and confidence in the future, we range ourselves with fear beside Britain. Where she goes, we go. Where she stands, we stand. We are only one small and young nation, but we are one and all a band of brothers, and we march forward with union of hearts and wills to a common destiny." Now, I can't imagine any politician in New Zealand saying anything even remotely similar to that now. Although the historic and even genetic ties to Britain are strong, New Zealand no longer sees itself as an appendage of Britain, or even as a child of Britain necessarily. maybe a grandchild of Britain, but there's far more nationhood here now than there was in those days. Now, you have to remember that the war started the year before the centenary of the Treaty of Waitangi, which is 1940 was when the centennial was held. So, in a sense, the sense of New Zealand's nationhood was still evolving and developing at the time. And so that's why so much of the words that were used at that time were very Britain-centric. And, of course, as I said, times have changed. But that was an important day. And, of course, a lot of New Zealanders lost their lives in World War II, both in the Pacific and in Europe. And it's something that is one of the things that's commemorated each Anzac Day, which started, of course, as a commemoration of the landings at Gallipoli in April of 1914. So that's the historic significance of today. And speaking of historic significance, actually, it's no historic significance to this, the infamous smacking referendum finally is over and has moved into the next phase, the political jockeying. Now, I, of course, predicted that the bad guys would win, and they would win quite handily by huge margin, and I was absolutely right. When the preliminary results were announced, which was the evening of the deadline day, it said that 87.6% of voters had voted no, and only 11.81% had voted yes, which is roughly what I expected. I mean, I expected it could be 90% no. And, of course, immediately the Christianists who were behind the organization started saying that nearly 88% of New Zealanders voted to overturn the smacking ban. Well, they did no such thing, because you will remember that the question asked should a smack as part of loving parental discipline be a criminal offense or whatever it was. And the vast majority of people obviously said no, but that's not the same thing as saying that they want to repeal the law. That was never asked. The question that was asked is, should it be a criminal offense? Which, of course, the current law does not create. There is no criminal offense created by the current law. So it was a nonsense thing to say. But what got under my cap was that, being my bonnet, was that 87.6% thing that they were touting. It's a meaningless statistic, and here's why. Of all of the voters who enrolled, which in America we used to call registered voters, only 54.07%, according to the preliminary reports, actually bothered to vote. So what that means is that only 47.37% of all enrolled voters actually voted no. Granted, only 6.38% voted yes. But that means that 45.93% of all New Zealand's enrolled voters didn't vote. Now, we can't guess what they would have voted had they voted. Obviously, there's no way of knowing that. But what it means is that the majority of New Zealanders did not vote no. The majority of voters either voted yes or didn't vote at all. I mean, the second biggest group of all were those who didn't vote. So it is dishonest for the Christianists to go around saying that 87.6% of New Zealanders voted to repeal the smacking ban. Is doubly dishonest, first of all, because they were never asked that question, and second of all, because that's only the number of people who bothered to vote. And so I blogged about this, of course, and I was trying to shed a little light on that subject. Now, since I posted that, it's on my blog, and if I remember, I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to read it. The final results have been posted. Now, I haven't done an updated graphic for that, but there were only slight changes, really not enough to really affect things in a great dramatic detail. But the point still is that the proponents of the smacking referendum were greatly overstating the case, as I suspected they would do. And in the immediate aftermath, however, there was a positive development. The New Zealand Herald reported that over the past 6 years, Focus on the Family New Zealand had received over $1 million from its U.S. parent organization. And was trying to pass itself off as a Kiwi organization when clearly it got huge support from U.S. fundamentalists. And, of course, they claimed that they're independent, and yet virtually all the materials that they distribute come from the U.S., and they used the same rabidly anti-gay theology and hyper-masculine theology. So, I mean, there's really no difference between them. But this was the first time that I've seen that any mainstream news media in New Zealand has reported on the nefarious connections among the Christianist right in New Zealand. So I was really pleased to see that. I wish they'd done it sooner, but nevertheless, you know, it's better late than never. But then I did a follow-up post about this whole thing because this guy named Bob McCroskey, who I've mentioned before, who's head of the far-right Christianist group Family First, said that the result was said that John Key had to basically do what McCroskey wanted, which is to repeal the bill. He said, John Key, who's the prime minister, by the way, John Key cannot ignore this result. And he was saying that because the National Party only received about 45% of the popular vote in the 2008 general election. So what he was trying to suggest is that if the prime minister and the National Party don't do what the Christianists want, that they will lose the polls. Now, of course, that's just bullshit. I mean, on its face, it's nonsense. And the main reason is, of course, that it's incredibly stupid and the height of ignorance or hubris or something for them to think that all of those people who voted for National would vote against National because of this. They don't know that. They can't assume that. They're just bluffing. And, of course, for that matter, it's nonsense to assume that that all of the people who voted for the referendum were National supporters in the first place, because the support clearly came from across many parties. So they're blowing smoke out their bums when they talk like that. But, I mean, that's what this McCroskey fellow does. And I said that last time, too. He says a lot of bullshit. He huffs and puffs and tries to blow your house down. But at the end of the day, he's got nothing to back it up. And to drive home that point in my follow-up post, I put links to the election results from all of the MMP elections, which is the system we currently use, going back to 1996. And the reason I did that is because no Christianist party has ever crossed the 5% threshold to get representation in parliament, and they've never won an electorate seat. The closest they ever came was in 1996, the first MMP election, when the Christian Coalition, which was a sort of a joint party or joint campaign between the Christian Democrats and the Christian Heritage Party, received 4.33%. That's the closest that they've ever gotten, and it's been all downhill from there. So there's absolutely no reason to think that sensible Kiwi voters, even if they are conservative Christians, would be dumb enough to vote for to throw away their vote for a Christianist party. So this Bob McCroskey and Larry Baldock and all these other people I've talked about who are behind the referendum, they're going to go away ultimately because there's nothing to back them up. And the mainstream politicians, the real politicians, all know that. The prime minister knows that. The leader of the opposition knows that. They all know that. They know that these Christianists are just all smoke and mirrors. However, one of the things that we have in Parliament is a thing called a private member's bill. And the way that works is that a member of Parliament will draft a bill and they'll put it in a lottery, essentially, to be drawn and considered by Parliament. And one of the first ones that came up after the referendum was from the Neoconservative ACT Party to repeal the bill. So this whole thing is going to be going through Parliament again. And I would say I think I can say without fear of contradiction that the average New Zealander is well and truly sick of this subject. However they voted in the referendum, they want it to be over. And there is no way that the Christianists are going to be able to drag this out for about two more years to the next New Zealand general elections. Which is another reason why they can't make good on their threats. But I suspect that the government and the opposition will sort of work together to try to kill this off. And so the right wing is going to be left floundering. It's going to be over before the end of this year, probably maybe even before Christmas. And that should be the end of it, because neither the National Party nor the Labour Party wants to keep this going. It doesn't serve any of their interests. And they know that if they kill it off, that the Christianists can't do anything about it, and that will essentially neutralize them as a political force. Yes, they're still going to be moaning about it. They're going to still be fundraising over it and complaining and carrying on. But at the end of the day, they will be the losers. So that's a little update on that whole political drama. And I don't think I'm actually going to have any occasion to mention it again, which is probably news that's being received with some glee by some people. But now for something completely different and completely better, our trip to Northland. Now, it was basically our honeymoon, as I said before, although it does feel a bit strange to call it that when we've already been together for 13 years. But that's what it was, because the family gave it to us for, as our civil union present. And so it essentially makes it our honeymoon. We had arranged for Nigel's mom to come up and stay at the house to stay with Jake. And she came up on Sunday, and we left Monday, late morning, maybe 10 or 11, somewhere in there, and headed out. We decided, now this part won't make any sense to anybody who doesn't live in Auckland, but the road north used to be pretty treacherous. It was windy and it was long. You had to go through all of these towns, and they sort of straightened it out. They've been working on it off and on for about 10 years, and they not so very long ago opened a new stretch that's a toll road. It's between a town called Albany, which is north of us, and Puhoi, which is further north, and that's a toll road. Now, we've never taken it. And they have no toll collectors. What you can do is you can either stop before you get onto it at a kiosk and pay your fee, or you can pay online. You've got up to 3 days to pay it. So if you just take the road, then when you get to your destination or within 3 days, you can log on and pay your toll online. There are no collectors. What they do is they take a photograph of your car with the registration, and that if you don't pay, there's a penalty. There's a $200 fine, I think it is, if you don't pay the toll. And it's actually kind of interesting because at the kiosks, at the vending machines is what they are basically, you enter in the license plate number for the car you're driving. It tells you what it is instantly, which is kind of creepy in a way. And then you've got several payment options. You can pay by FPOS, you know, with a debit card, or you can pay with credit card, or you can pay with cash. There's a little sign that tells you if you pay by cash that no records are kept of who paid it. And I thought that was fascinating because it sort of works for all kinds of different people. The people who you could take it two ways. The people who don't want their movements tracked would prefer to pay by cash, obviously. But it also is a way of saying to business people, look, you're not going to have any proof that you are the one who paid this. You're going to get reimbursement from your employer, so you might want to use something else. So there's a couple different ways of looking at that. The only complaint I had, the road was great. It reminded me a lot of Australia, especially on the central coast north of Sydney. But the thing that annoyed me about it is we pulled off to this sort of service area, I guess, a petrol station and a McDonald's and stuff like that. A Burger King it was, actually. And the machines were located inside this building. But there's no signs to tell you that's where it is. We're driving around this car park. It's raining down by this point. We're looking for where these things are. We thought they'd be outside undercover. And then I finally see one of those little signs that you sometimes see out on the footpath directing you into a cafe saying, oh, they're located across from whatever the hell it was, the place where you get coffee inside the petrol station complex. And so we parked and we went in, and I was able to figure it out fairly easily. But it certainly wasn't obvious, and I thought it would have been helpful if they'd put signs on the outside. Now, when we came home, actually, we noticed that on the southbound lane, the things are on the outside, and they're sitting on the they're sitting undercover, but just in the car park. There's no building or anything, and I thought that was kind of interesting. So anyway, we took this road. It was great. We got to the other side of it, and the road narrows down to two lanes again, and we were stopped. And it turns out they were doing lane painting on the road that day and some other bits and pieces on the side. So we got delayed there for a while. Finally headed out. We're heading north, and we thought we would have lunch in one of the towns along the way. So we stopped at some of them and didn't really see anything we liked. We could have had McDonald's and all that, but nah, I don't really want that. So we thought we'd go to the first major town along the way, which is called Whangarei. And you come over the Brynderwyns, which is a hill range in that area. And you come up and you're on high ground. And as you're coming back down to sea level, you look out and you can see on a nice, bright, sunny day, you see Whangarei Harbor. And it's just, it's a really pretty sight. Well, this wasn't one of those days. The weather was so shocking, you couldn't really see much of anything. So it wasn't nearly as nice as it usually is. We drove into Whangarei. We couldn't find anything decent. It was a Monday, after all, and a lot of places were closed. We finally ended up going to this little shopping mall, and they had two choices. They had a McDonald's, and they had an Indian place. Now, we both like Indian, but we were traveling. We thought we don't want to take the risk of getting something that doesn't agree with us. So we ended up having McDonald's after all, and we were not happy about it. But nevertheless, we'd left it so long that we had to have something by then. This is about one or so. And Whangarei basically is nothing to write home about. It's kind of a gritty town. It's a very large town or very small city, depending on your point of view. It has some charm, and on a sunny day, it's much nicer. But I wouldn't want to live there. It's not that nice. So we hit the road again, and our next stop was a town called Kawakawa, which is famous for two things. First of all, it has railroad tracks going down the middle of the main road. Now, I've since done some research and found out that the railroad tracks actually aren't used anymore, but they are going to be working on establishing a sort of a scenic train that will go down the middle of the road. It's sort of a tourist thing. But the other thing it's famous for are the public toilets, and not for the reason you're thinking, you naughty people. They were designed by an Austrian artist by the name of Friedrich Hundertwasser, who apparently is world-renowned. I'd never heard of him before, but apparently he was quite famous. He designed a lot of buildings. His style reminds me a bit of the Spanish architect Gaudi, if you've ever heard of him. And he designed these public toilets in the early or late 90s. I've forgotten when it was. He lived in the area at the time, and he died sometime thereafter. I think it is the only structure he designed in the entire Southern Hemisphere, and they're bloody toilets. I should say that I have pictures of some of the stuff, including the toilets, on my Flickr site, and I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes to that as well, in case you want to go have a look. But they're very unusual. A lot of broken tiles and bottles for windows, and it's kind of surreal in a lot of ways. But it's one of those must-see things. It's on the list of 100 things that to see in New Zealand or whatever. So we did. And now I don't have to see them again. And so we headed off from there. And our next stop actually was only about an hour north when we got to Paihia, which is the Bay of Islands. And again, it was kind of a rainy day, so it wasn't as pretty as it could have been. But even so, you come into Paihia from a rise, and so you can see the Bay of Island. And on a clear day, it must be absolutely beautiful. It was pretty, but it wasn't nearly as fantastic as it must be on a sunny day. And Paihia is a little seaside town, clearly a summer community. But nice, you know. It's well presented. It's small. It's not. There's nothing big about it. But I'm sure it's quite packed in the summertime. But we weren't actually in Paihia. We were in the next town along, which is called Waitangi, and which I've mentioned several times before. But that's where our hotel actually was. So we went there and checked in and got all that sorted. That was fine. And then we decided to come back into Paihia and have a drive around and to actually explore it a little bit. We drove through Paihia onto a town called Opua, which is where the car ferry to Russell docks. Now, I've never been on a car ferry in my life, so I was a bit dubious about all this. We stayed there, and we watched the car ferry come in, unload its cars, and the next cars loaded on, and then it sailed away. And so I'm thinking, okay. Now, I should probably say that I have a deathly fear of boats, because, well, I grew up in the middle of a continent. What do you expect? But I don't swim well. I can barely tread water, and I have this fear of drowning. And so boats are not my friend. And so I'm really leery about this whole thing. But the only other alternative is a passenger ferry that goes from Paihia to Russell. And Nigel wasn't keen on that because he said, you know, we get over them, we'd be trapped. Whereas if we took the car ferry, we'd be able to drive around and have some, you know, freedom and stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm sure I can gird my loins and prepare myself for that when the time comes. We went back into Paihia and wandered around a bit. We ended up having dinner at a Thai restaurant in town, which was okay. It was just okay. We thought about going to the hotel, but when we checked in, they said, now, you better make reservations because it's very busy. And we were concerned that you might have to dress up, and we didn't feel like dressing up, and that it might be crowded. And so we thought, no, we'll just give it a miss. So we did. We didn't end up having our dinner at the hotel that night, but at the Thai restaurant in town instead. And so we went back to the hotel, but it was a bit early, so we just relaxed for a little bit, and then we went down to the hotel bar, which is a bit of a grand term for what it really was. It's more like a lounge. And I ordered wine, and Nigel had some tea, and he also had dessert, which they bring in from the restaurant, which she enjoyed very much. We had fun making fun of the English tourists, to be honest, because they were not adventurous in a culinary way. This one gentleman there, they had offered a steak sandwich, was on focaccia bread, and had garlic aioli and avocado and other things. And he said, oh, I don't want the avocado. Can I have it without the avocado in the salad? And Can I have bacon instead? Well, yeah, I suppose you can do that. And it doesn't have garlic, does it? Well, it's got garlic aioli. Oh, I don't want any of that. So we ended up basically with a bacon and steak sandwich is what it was. And then this family was in the bar area as well. And they went up to the bar, and the little boy, he was about 14 maybe, 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. And they said, well, would it be possible to get some chicken nuggets, which are not on the menu? Oh, yeah, we can probably arrange that. And he's really sick of chips. Could he have baked beans instead? So they got him baked beans. And Nigel and I were just giggling quietly to ourselves about all of this because we're thinking, you know, you're thousands of miles from home, and all you want to do is eat just like you do at home? I mean, you know, why don't you try what the people in the country eat? But anyway, so that was our evening, and we went to bed and went to sleep actually fairly early. The next day, we got up at a decent hour, and we came fairly early, came down to the hotel restaurant where they have a buffet breakfast, which is included in our room, and we had that. And then we headed off to the treaty grounds at Waitangi. Now, that is where the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, which officially made New Zealand part of the British Empire and made the people in New Zealand British subjects. And this has all sorts of historic significance. And I've talked about the treaty in the past, but there's a couple of things that I think bear repeating. And first, it's the first time that Britain had entered into a treaty with a country that was about to become its colony, basically what happened. Before, it had always just moved in, or it had conquered it by force, or both. This was the first time they did it with consent of the people living there. And so that was unusual in itself. Now, there's a lot of history that's behind this, why it happened. The French were making territorial claims in the South Pacific generally. They already had a settlement in Ekaroa near Christchurch in the South Island. Some guy had proclaimed himself supreme chief or something in the Hokianga, which is an area sort of to the west-ish of the Bay of Islands. So the French were really starting to nip at the heels of Britain, and they needed to do something fast in order to create sovereignty over New Zealand. And there was a guy who was there at the time named James Busby, who had been appointed the first British resident. And a resident is, I don't know what they are in modern terms, sort of like a chargé d'affaires or not a consul, but something like that. You know, basically the person who looks after British interests is what he was. And he persuaded a bunch of northern chiefs, including in the Hokianga, to declare independence and their own sovereignty, basically. And they were the United, well, they have had several names, but among them was the United Northern Tribes at one stage, United Chiefs of the Northern Tribes, several different names. And that flag is actually still around. It's actually quite a nice flag. Anyway, they did that. And then what that did is that created a country that then could ask for protection from the British Empire. And he built a house at Waitangi with funds from New South Wales. The Governor General of New South Wales approved the money. New South Wales is Sydney and all that in Australia. And but the Governor General felt it was too expensive, so he had to cut the size of the house in half or make it smaller at any rate. So that was the sort of the milieu that was going on at the time. Pressure from the French, the need to establish sovereignty, and James Busby was there. So he got the chiefs together, and in 1840, he was replaced by the first governor of New Zealand, who, what the hell was his name? I've suddenly blanked out on his name. I cannot remember his name. I'm sorry, I should look that up, but I don't remember it. The point is, he convened this meeting in February of 1840 with these chiefs and the British, and they on February 6th, they signed the Treaty of Waitangi, which, as I said, was essentially the founding of New Zealand. And the treaty grounds are where that all happened. The estate was privately held, and after James Busby died, his widow and children had it, and they eventually sold it. I think it was sold a few times. In about 1905 and 1911 or thereabouts, the property was offered for sale again, and it was offered for sale with plans to subdivide it into essentially a small town, which is kind of phenomenal when you think about it. There, in terms of New Zealand nationhood, there's probably no more sacred spot in New Zealand than Waitangi and what we now call the treaty grounds. It's kind of like if they had decided to bulldoze Independence Hall in Philadelphia and put in a car park. It's just, it's that jarring. But the thing that you have to remember about, well, let me just carry on a little bit. That didn't happen. And it was coming up for sale again in the 1930s. And there had been a member of parliament who had been trying for years and years and years and years to get this, to get the New Zealand government to buy the treaty grounds and to make it basically a place for all New Zealanders. And he just couldn't succeed. The MP's name was Vernon Reid. I had to look it up while I was talking. And so in 1932, it was being offered for sale again. And in, I guess it was November of that year, he, this Vernon Reid, had invited the Governor General of the day, who was Lord Bledisloe, to come and visit. And so he came up there, and he took a look at it, and he bought the land. He put an offer on the land, and there's a little bit of worry because someone else had put an offer on the land, and it ultimately didn't, the sale didn't go through. So Lord and Lady Bledisloe bought the land, the estate, and it's about 1,000 acres, I think, and gifted it to the people of New Zealand, which is actually fairly extraordinary. Now, I mentioned something about it to Nigel's mum when we got back. Now, she doesn't remember this. She was born after this. But she said that he loved New Zealand and its people. And by everything I've read, that's apparently true. And it was an extraordinary thing. But one of the caveats or whatever that he put on this gift was that it had to be open to the people of New Zealand. And to this day it is. When we got there, we knew that there was an admission charge. We thought it was $19. We saw a sign that said the admission charge was $20. That's 20 New Zealand, of course. Except that it's free to New Zealand residents. So all we had to do was show our driver's licenses, and we were admitted free, which I thought was pretty cool. And by the way, the entrance there is really cool. The visitor center is just kind of small and nothing much to it. But once you walk out the back door, you walk through this dense bush over these wooden sort of pathway kind of things that are up in the air. They're elevated and leading to the paths ultimately that lead up to the treaty grounds, because the treaty grounds are on high ground. So you've got to get up to the hilltop, and that sort of cuts across. And the thing is that it is completely quiet there. All you can hear are birds. Birds like you'd never hear anywhere else in New Zealand, I don't think. It was just wonderful, even despite the rainy conditions. It was really beautiful. And the treaty grounds themselves are now kept very clear and clean, huge green lawn. One end is the Treaty House, or the Busby House, as it's sometimes known. Lord Bledisloe stipulated that it should be called the Treaty House. At the other end is the flagpole, which marks the spot where the treaty was actually signed. And on that flagpole is at the main one is the New Zealand flag, and one side is the British Union Jack, and then the third flag is the flag from the Confederation of Chiefs, or whatever it's called, because they were the ones who at that time were technically sovereign in that area. And right next to the treaty ground, sort of at a right angle to the treaty house, is a Maori meeting house, and it doesn't represent any particular tribe, but rather it was intended to be a meeting place for all New Zealanders and all iwi, or all Maori tribes, to jointly have that as their meeting house. And it's really quite lovely. If you ever get a chance to go to Waitangi, it's definitely worth checking out. But the views from up there are absolutely spectacular. And again, I have some photos on my Flickr page, but it doesn't do it justice, I'm afraid, because it wasn't sunny enough. But that was, of all the things we were going to do in Northland, that was at the top of my list. I really wanted to go to Waitangi. I've wanted to go to Waitangi ever since I've been in New Zealand. And that was, of course, my first chance. So I was really happy by then. And I thought, well, the least I can do then is go on this car ferry, which was our next stop. So we drove down to Opua, which is not that far, really. But it's sort of around a bend in the bay. And got on the car ferry, and that was no big drama. The crossing was smooth, so I didn't feel the water at all. And I just tried not to think too much about the fact that I could drown inside a metal box, because we're sitting in the car, of course, the whole time. And we got to the other side and drove off to Russell, and just through these back ways. Apparently, if you go from Paihia to Russell by the car ferry, it takes something like 20 minutes or thereabouts. If you drive by the road, it takes nearly 2 hours. And the reason is that apparently a lot of the road is unsealed, like a gravel road. And so you have to go very slow, and apparently it's quite treacherous. I don't know. We didn't do that, so I don't know. So we go up to Russell, and by this time it was really raining, And Russell is nothing to write home about. It's a little seaside village. It's quaint. It's fairly historic. I'm sure on a sunny day it's much nicer. But I wasn't that impressed with it, I'll be honest with you. In the 19th century, especially toward the end of the 19th century, it was, or the mid-19th century, it was a whaling station. And whalers from all over, especially a lot of American whalers, would stop at Russell to resupply or just to let off steam or whatever. So a particularly lawless place, by all account. And it was almost directly across the bay from Waitangi. And whaling ships would sometimes call in at Waitangi as well because there was a military garrison there and make repairs and things. And actually, when we visited the Treaty House, there was a display relating to these American visitors in the whaling ships that had come over the years. And there was a log of all these ships who had visited and so on, which is kind of interesting, kind of ironic with me being there. So anyway, we had lunch in Russell and then started heading back because there really is not much there. And on the way back, we stopped at a little place called Okeato, however you pronounce it. I don't know how to pronounce it, which was the site of New Zealand's first capital. They called it Russell then, but it wasn't actually Russell. And that actually cleared something up for me because I'd always heard that Russell was New Zealand's first capital, which is the main reason I wanted to go there. It turns out it wasn't. It was actually this place. And there's nothing there but a sign. Now, maybe there's something down closer to the water. It was raining, and I didn't get out to look because it's sort of over a hill to get to the water. But it didn't look like it. And that's fairly typical of New Zealand. This is what I was starting to say about the treaty grounds. Up until certainly the centenary in 1940, and even to some extent for some time later, there was very little regard placed on the historic sites of New Zealand. People just didn't seem to care about them very much. And it stands to reason when you think that for the first century of New Zealand's existence, from 1840 to 1940, basically the population was spending a lot of time looking back to England. Many of them had come from the British Isles, or their parents did, or maybe the grandparents. They were maybe only one or two generations at most removed from the motherland, as they often called it. And so they didn't really think about anything that happened in New Zealand as being worth noting or remarking, because obviously in England you've got monuments all over the place. And so they just didn't pay much attention to it. And that's why in a historically significant place like Waitangi could have been allowed to fall into almost be obliterated. As a matter of fact, at the time that Lord Bledisloe bought it, it was in quite a state of disrepair, apparently, the estate and the house too, and had to be restored. And so the fact that there's nothing at the site of the first capital, apart from just a sort of a general sign saying that this is where it was, not even a marker, it's just a sign, isn't surprising. I mean, a lot of the battlefields from various wars in New Zealand also have no monuments or markers even to tell you what was fought there. And that's a bit of a shame too. And I hope that one day that changes, because it would be good for, I think, oh, I always think, of course, it's good for people to know the history of their place. But anyway, we headed back into Paihia. We did go to Paihia for a little while. We just stopped and freshened up. And then we headed out again to Kerikeri, which is also in that region, but it's kind of, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour away. It's a much bigger town than Paihia. And in Kerikeri are two buildings of significance. There's the Kerikeri Mission House, which is the oldest wooden structure in New Zealand. It was built in 1822. And right next to that is the Old Stone Store, which is the oldest stone structure in New Zealand. It was built in 1835. And both of them have been threatened by floods periodically, but they're still standing. And it's worth having a quick look at them, only for historic reasons. And I actually didn't know about the Mission House. I feel ignorant. But I didn't know about that. I did know about the Old Stone Store, and that was the other thing I really wanted to see in New Zealand. I mean, I wanted to go to Russell because I'd read that it was the first capital. Didn't know I had the wrong Russell. But anyway, the main thing I wanted to see was Waitangi, and I also wanted to see the Old Stone Store because I knew it was in the same general area. And so I was, happy as a pig in slop because I had seen what I wanted to see. And it was a rainy day. It was raining quite a lot when we were in Kerikeri. And we ended up then just coming back to the hotel. We ended up having dinner at the hotel that night. And I'll tell you what we have, but I wrote it down, but I don't know what I did with it. So I'll just have to put it in my blog post when I finally do the travel log. And if you're really interested, you'll have to go have a look there. But I'm just having another quick look now. Anyway, And that was lovely. We had a lovely dinner there, and I had a Chardonnay from Northland. Now I say it like that because I had no idea that they produced Chardonnay in Northland, but it was very nice. It's called Shipwreck Bay. Chardonnays are sort of a dime a dozen these days, and some are nice and some are really awful. This was nice. It wasn't expensive. all wine at a bar or a hotel restaurant or whatever is expensive, but compared to some of the other things, it was closer to the bottom of the price range. But it was very nice. Anyway, that was our day, and that night we were both really quite tired, so we ended up going to sleep quite early. And the next morning we got up and had the buffet breakfast again, and finished getting ready, packed up, and checked out, and started heading home. Now, we had a choice at this point. We could go back the way we came, or we could divert in another direction to this place called Dargaville, which is on the western side of Northland, still north of Auckland, but getting closer to Auckland, and come back that way. Now, I've never been to that part of the country. I've never been to Dargaville. And so we thought, oh, what the hell, let's go there. And, GPS was saying that it was only going to take some like half an hour, 45 minutes longer. So why not? So we headed out, and we're watching these signs on the road, and it's saying that it's like 139 kilometers to Dargaville. And Nigel's thinking, shit, that's going to take forever. But then the GPS said, in 100 meters, turn left. And so we did. And then looked on it, and it said that it was something like 79 kilometers, or less than that even, I think, 59 kilometers to Dargaville. Because what it does, the GPS guided us through all of these back roads, through the back country, to get to Dargaville. Now, it ended up being quite scenic and quite lovely, really. But we never in a million years would have found that road if it hadn't been for the GPS. And it ended up being a really good thing because it got us there obviously much faster. But also took us through a part of the country that neither of us had ever been to before and wouldn't have ever been to otherwise. Now, the only downside of going that way is that we didn't go past Tane Mahuta, which is the giant kauri tree in Northland that most people want to go have their photo taken with. But, I mean, I can do that some other day. As much as I would like to see Tane Mahuta, I mean, by that point, I think I was ready to get home. So we headed off. Now, we got to Dargaville. We think we're going to have to have lunch somewhere along the way. We got to Dargaville, and there was absolutely nothing to recommend it. If Russell was kind of eh, and Whangarei was not my kind of place, Dargaville was even worse. It was really rough and a bit, not shabby exactly, because that's not exactly true, but just kind of stuck. It just didn't seem to be have progressed any, although it had a brand new warehouse store, but it just was a bit, nah. So we didn't stay there long, just had a pee stop, and then headed out again, continuing on the way home. And eventually the road joins back up with State Highway 1, which is the road that we would normally be taking. And we ended up stopping at a cafe. I've forgotten the name of the town off the top of my head, but that's in the photos as well. And it turned out that the cafe was run by a couple of lesbians. And because we're a bit tired by this point, we didn't clock it at first. Nigel said, "Did you see their aprons?" And they had these little rainbow flag things, kind of like a Levi's tag down in the pockets of their aprons. And so just as we were getting ready to leave, one of them said, "So are you on your way home or back?" I said, "Yeah, heading back to Auckland." And then he added, "We've been on our honeymoon." And she said, "Oh, really? Oh, that's so great." And her partner came out and she said, "Oh, blessings to you both." And it was just nice. And the secret story behind that is that for the whole time we were away, Nigel was just dying to tell somebody that we were on our honeymoon. But it just didn't come up. He would have had to have just brought it up out of nowhere, kind of like somebody with Tourette's when they just say something that out of context doesn't mean anything. Well, this was the first time it came up. So he was feeling very happy that he had a chance to say it to somebody. We got in the car, headed back, and we were probably home within an hour after that. And this was early Wednesday afternoon. And that was our trip, and that was the end of it. The next day was Nigel's birthday, and we just ended up having dinner at home. Nigel's mom made it for us, and his sister and niece came by. They usually come by on Fridays anyway, because that's our normal takeaway night. But they came by on Thursday, and we had a lovely time. And that was pretty much our entire holiday adventure. And probably it bored you to tears by now telling you about all of our adventures doing this. But the thing is, there's a couple things about this. First, Nigel and I never fight when we go on a trip together. No, not that we normally fight. But I mean, well, all couples have arguments from time to time. They say that it's a healthy thing. It clears the air, blah, 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 whatever. But we don't do it when we're on trips. I have no idea why that is. I mean, it's not like we put on special behavior or anything. It's just we don't. And the other thing is that we really enjoy being together wherever we get. Okay, get out your insulin syringes. You might need it. But the truth is we really enjoy each other's company. We enjoy going and seeing things together and just being together. And I mean, I said that there are these things I wanted to see up there, Waitangi and the Old Stone Store, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is that I'm just happy wherever Nigel is. And if we're in the middle of nowhere, as we were in part of the trip, that's fine with me too. So it was just nice to be away together and spend some time just sort of seeing things together and having adventures together, because we like to have adventures. And it was a lovely time away. It was quite short, but it was a lovely time away. And we both enjoyed it very much. And as I said, I have posted photos to the Flickr page. I have not yet written up the travelogue, but I eventually will. So you might want to check my blog, amarin.blogspot.com. At some stage, and you can read in detail with all the links to all the places that I've talked about. I just haven't had time to finish it yet this week. But be that as it may. And good grief, I've already been blathering on for 46 minutes. Who could know that? And now I'm going to switch gears and talk about comments and things. I've actually got quite a few different things that I want to go over. And first, on the last episode, I had a voicemail from Rebecca, who's a Kiwi living in the U.S., and I invited her to email me and tell me more about her story, and she has done so. So I thought I'd like to share that. She says, "I hope you had a great holiday. I've always wanted to go to the far north. You were kind enough to play my comment on your most recent podcast, and I suggest I drop you a line with something about my expatriate experience. I'm a mainlander by birth." That means somebody from the South Island. "I'm a mainlander by birth and upbringing, and grew up thinking of Auckland as impossibly big and incredibly far away. A friend had to explain the concept of exit-only lanes on a motorway when I was in my early 20s. But not long after that, I graduated from Otago with an arts degree and few long-term job prospects. To while away the idle hours, I applied to graduate schools, and failing to get into any Australian ones, I moved on to American ones. When I was accepted to a couple, I felt obligated to go. So I thought, what could possibly go wrong? And bought a one-way ticket to America. The whole idea was so exotic, the local paper in my hometown ran a story about my departure." I can't imagine that. "Anyway, in grad school, I met the American I eventually married, and 18 years later, here I still am. I became an American citizen in time to vote in the last election. I still hold my New Zealand citizenship, so last October I got to vote in two elections. I guess I have a lot of pent-up activism from all those years of forced political inactivity, and now I'm very involved in the campaign for healthcare reform here. So my immigration was entirely unplanned and still seems rather surprising to me. It's hard to convey how completely unlikely this would have seemed to me right up until it happened. It's forced me to wrestle with who I really am and what identifies me. It's taken me a long time to admit that, having spent most of my adult life in America, I'm just as much an American as a Kiwi these days. I come home every year and have noticed that lately I've been kvetching about the lack of central heating and effective plumbing in Godzone." Godzone is a name for New Zealand. "But then in the U.S., I kvetch about the lack of meat pies and consistent uniforms for police officers. So maybe it's just me. How are you finding your relationship to America, things American, and your own American-ness developing and changing? Rebecca." Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. That's actually very enlightening. And I emailed back, and one of the things I said was that I have found many of the same things, especially relating to identity and, you know, that sort of stuff. And one of the things I thought was interesting about what she said, well, first of all, that her immigration was entirely unplanned, because basically, in a sense, mine was too. It's not something I ever anticipated doing, certainly, and it just kind of happened. Granted, it took a few months before it got to that point, but nevertheless, it was certainly something it was never in my life's plan. But, you know, talking about this whole thing about wrestling with who you are and what identifies you, I think that that's something that's fairly common to expats when they are long-term immigrants, because you're, for a long time, you're stuck between two countries. You're of neither, really. And it takes a while to develop an identity with the new place, and yet you never lose your connections to the old place, which is why, well, both Rebecca and I are dual nationals. I'm a citizen of the U.S. and a citizen of New Zealand because I have no intention of giving up my heritage. It's part of who I am. It's part of what makes me me. But by the same token, I've lived in New Zealand for 13 years, and I feel that I'm as much a New Zealander certainly as any other immigrant. And I have the same rights and privileges certainly as anyone born here as a citizen. And you do eventually develop a connection with your local place, especially the longer you're there. And I said this way back when, the longer you are in the country that you've moved to, the more you start to build up memories and associations with the place that you are now living. And that means that you eventually become a part of the place. But that doesn't take away anything you were. And so when she talks about, you know, how you're finding your relationship to America, things American, and your own Americanness, and how are they changing? Well, they are evolving, certainly. I get, as every listener will know, I get incredibly frustrated with American politics sometimes, especially over the healthcare reform debate. But I recognize that I am not a part of the flow. It's sort of like when you're, you know, walking around with a crowd of people and you step to the side and they keep going. Well, that's sort of what it's like. I'm still kind of part of that crowd, but I'm apart from it. And I realize that and I recognize that. And it means that a lot of times I don't know what people are talking about. And I've said this before too. If they're talking about something in pop culture, I may have no idea what they're on about. And but I suppose by the same token, I might talk about something here in New Zealand and somebody in America wouldn't have any idea what I'm talking about either. So I guess it's kind of the same. But it took me – the hardest – I was thinking about this just recently. The hardest thing for me to come to terms with as a immigrant from the U.S. was that the people that I left behind left me behind as well. And what I mean by that is that I left to come here and they obviously carried on with their lives, and their lives took many varied and interesting twists and turns along the way, none of which involved me. And it took me a while to sort of, well, to come to terms with it, yes, but even to accept it, because what it meant is I had to accept that I was no longer part of their lives. And in some cases, that means that friendships have fallen by the wayside. It was to be expected. 13 years on, all these thousands of kilometers, and I don't see them. You know, that could be expected. There are some obvious and rare exceptions. I mean, Jason obviously is one of them, my family and so on. But nevertheless, all of them, even them, have gotten on with their lives and done things that I'm not a part of directly anymore. And that actually took some adjustment and some getting used to. And even now, sometimes I get little pangs of feeling bad that I'm not part of something. But it's the way it is. And over time, obviously the longer time that passes, the easier it is to cope with such things. But it was probably the thing that I found the most difficult in all that time. But I obviously still consider myself to be American and a New Zealander, and with strong identities associated with both, and strong connections with both. They're just different, and it's one of those things. It's kind of terrible to say, but it's one of those things that unless you experience it, you can't really get it. And I don't mean that as to be dismissive in any way. It's just that I never could have understood it if I hadn't done it. If somebody had tried to explain to me what it's like, I don't think I ever could have gotten it. The closest thing I can think of is if you move to an entirely different city in your own country that's far away from the one you were in. And I've said this, I've touched on this before, I suppose. And that's the closest that I can think of. But in my case, I moved so far away, so many time zones, so many thousands of kilometers away that it's a bit more of a serious thing than just moving, you know, across country. And I certainly know that the East Coast and West Coast in the U.S., for instance, are quite a ways away from each other, and I don't mean to belittle that in any way. I'm just saying that when you're talking about moving countries and hemispheres and all of that, that becomes a really quite a big deal. But I'll probably talk about some of these more in the future. And actually, I should say, by the way, that I have been getting several emails with topic suggestions for future podcasts, and I'm absolutely going to be addressing most of those starting soon. So keep those cards and letters coming. If you have something, a particular topic you'd like to see me address or expand on or whatever, by all means, just let me know. I'm always looking for new ideas for topics. But now moving into sort of a group of topics, an email came in, and I don't know if I should say who it's from because it doesn't say. But he says, I would definitely be interested in following an additional political talk group that is streamed live. I would like to suggest one consideration. We know that there's only one time zone that counts. That's a reference to Big Fatty, of Big Fatty Online, who always talks about the Eastern time zone as being the only one that matters. Anyway, says, could the person in this zone be kept up a little late for your show? Those of us in the Mountain and Pacific time zones are getting off work as Archer from Archer Radio is doing his show and frequently not able to be part of it. However, no matter how you will do it, I will be at least listening to your podcast, at least. Thank you for that. And as I say, I can't say that it's a listener from Colorado. but thanks for that. And I am actually keenly aware of the time zone thing. And it's a difficult thing to balance because I have the luxury for doing a live show, actually. This is one of the few times when this time zone thing works in my favor. Because the optimal time zone times or whatever for recording for U.S. time are all in the daytime for me, early day to from late morning to early afternoon, basically. So it works really well for me. And I'm sure that we'll work something out. But I don't know any of the specifics yet about what's going to be happening with that. And I will be talking more about that. And I'm going to be talking more about that right now because I have another email from Moose who says, I was catching up on podcasts this morning on my bike ride. Your Amarin show was one that I listened to. I don't know when you mentioned that you are considering live shows, but I hope you do. I listen often to the live shows on Pride 48 and really enjoy them. So my vote is yes on live shows. Also, I love the shows where you have your husband on. You two are great together. I love his accent. Well, thank you, Moose. And the thing is, I have actually talked with Nigel about this, and he doesn't want to be on frequently. I mean, we joke about him not wanting to, not wanting his public to have too much of him or something. Or no, that's probably what I say. But he doesn't want to be on all the time for a variety of reasons. And he's not a podcaster. You know, fair enough. One of the things he will do, though, is, you know, there's been talk about doing this winter pride thing on Pride 48, which is ironic because it's the middle of summer here. Anyway, an extravaganza similar to what we all did in June. And he has said that he will be part of that. Whether he's part of any other live shows that I do, I don't know. It's probably not very likely because the shows that I do will be during the week while he's at work. And so it's not likely that we'll be able to schedule that unless he happens to have the day off or something. But we'll see. You just never know. Having said that, though, I wouldn't suggest counting on it because it's probably not going to be a very common thing. So anyway. But now over on the website, amarinspodcast.com, first up was Archer, who said, I'm so glad you voted. I was worried that you were going to ruin your record. Good for you. You certainly kept us listening to find out if you voted or not. Love that. Also, to the weekly live show, yes, you know I'll be listening and even participating. I think you should take my Wednesday time slot. Yes, yes, yes. And, of course, Archer's been doing a group show for, years. And that was one of the first things I did as a new podcaster. I think I had only put out one, maybe two episodes. Not much. And I was on an Archer Radio group show. And this is going back way back to, 2007, I guess. And it was a lot of fun. And over the years, I've been on several different times. Some of them have been really good. Some of them I haven't been so good. But, I mean, that's to be expected. That's true of my own podcast. So anyway, that's a good vote of confidence. Thank you for that, Archer. And next up was Stephen in Wisconsin. And, of course, if I say Stephen in Wisconsin, I have to play this.
Stephen from Wisconsin.
Okay, now, wait a minute. I can't play that. It's not from my show. That was from Dubious Intent and Daniel J. Brewer. Anyway, Stephen said, this will not likely come as a shock. In response to more live shows, you get a resounding yes, please, from me. Who couldn't want more Arthur? Oh, thank you, Stephen. And I am in the final stages of preparing to do more live shows, everyone. Thank you all for those who have responded, and people have also responded on Twitter, too, I should say. I will be doing more live shows. I haven't worked out all the details yet. The live shows are going to be group shows where basically anybody who's interested can come along and take part in the discussion. And I said before that they're going to be political. They won't necessarily be political in the literal sense of the word, like about partisan politics or specific legislation. They might be political in the more general sense, talking about issues or something like that. We'll see. We'll see how things go. But one of the things I'm planning on doing is that on the early part of the week, I will post on my site, amrinspodcast.com, essentially what will be kind of the show notes. I'll be talking about some of the topics that I plan on talking about, so that anybody who's interested in those topics, or particularly interested in those topics, I should say, can make sure that they're part of it. And that way, too, no one has to just say, oh, I'm just going to go and be on this and hope that they talk about something I'm interested in. Well, that's the plan anyway. Whether or not that works out, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But that's what I would like to do. So I will definitely keep you posted as to when all this will start and the actual days and times, whatever. As I said, a lot of these details are still being worked out, but they are to come. So stay tuned to this channel for more information. But that is it for today. There is a Two Political episode next week after the Labor Day holiday, and another Amrin's podcast next week as well. And that is it for today. That's it for this week. I hope that all of my American friends have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. It's just an ordinary weekend here in New Zealand. Although it's Father's Day on Sunday here in New Zealand. Did you know that? Thanks for listening. And I'll talk. Hold on a minute. I'm not quite done, as it turns out. It's now Friday, September 4th, 2009. And I wanted to just do a last-minute addendum under this podcast. And I know it's already way too long and way too rambling. I was actually going to re-record the whole thing. Then I decided I couldn't be bothered re-recording some of the stuff I said yesterday, even in the interest of shortening it. But I did want to add some things that I didn't say yesterday. First of all, there have been some important podcaster milestones I forgot to acknowledge. Tim from Terminally Single recently posted his 100th episode, and I forgot to acknowledge that. And Wes from the Live It Up podcast recently posted his 100th episode, and I forgot to acknowledge that. And, of course, Archer from Archer Radio has just posted his 1,000th episode. And that's why I especially wanted to add this addendum. Because those of you who listen to this have already listened to Archer Radio have probably already heard this, but Archer announced that he's essentially going on hiatus, and he's not going to be doing the group shows, not going to be doing the daily shows, nothing, pretty much. And I mean, I'm hoping that he can't stay away, that he'll just have to get back into it. But nevertheless, I didn't take the news all that well when I heard it. Now, admittedly, I've been very tired this week because I've been really burning more than midnight oil. Last night I didn't go to bed until after 3. And the thing is, and I've said this before, Archer Radio was one of the very first podcasts that I ever listened to, going way back, way before I was a podcaster myself. Of all of the podcasts that I originally listened to, his was the only one left that I was still listening to. The others had pod faded, and a couple I just had given up on myself. I didn't like them anymore. And so his was the only one left, and now it's gone too. So it's kind of like a death in the family. I don't know how else to put it, because I've been listening to it for all this time. It's been a part of my routine for a very long time now, for as long as, well, I suppose 2.5-3 years, something like that. And he'd already been well into it by the time I started listening, you see. And it's this sort of disruption that I wasn't quite prepared for. And so it feels very strange to know that I'm not going to be getting my daily fix of Archer Radio. I'm going to continue on. I'm not quitting just yet. I don't know if I'm going to make it all the way to 1,000 episodes, but I'm certainly nowhere near quitting. But nevertheless, I just wanted to pay tribute to Archer Radio, which was, as I said, one of the inspirations that led me to become a podcaster myself. And in this podcast, I just wanted to thank Archer for all that entertainment and especially for that inspiration. Archer has always been relentlessly supportive of other podcasters, and me in particular. I mean, I know obviously firsthand how supportive he's been of me, and I've appreciated all of that. I've appreciated his friendship. I've appreciated his allowing me to be part of his group shows, and it's been a wonderful experience sharing a little bit of Archer's life. Now, I will obviously move on. We all will. I hope that he will be back. But I'm got to kind of prepare myself just in case it doesn't happen. So thank you, Archer. Thank you for all of your hard work. And congratulations to Tim and to Wes as well for their recent milestones. That is it now for today and for this week. And I will be back next week with a Too Political and hopefully another Ordinary Amerinds podcast as well. By the way, I mentioned in the portion I recorded yesterday that I'm working on group shows. The only thing I'm waiting on now is scheduling for the Pride 48. And once I know when they're going to be, then I can proceed with getting things organized. But I'll keep you posted. Have a great weekend, everybody. Raise a glass to your fathers on our behalf, if you will, and I will rest for my labors on your behalf. Have a great weekend. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amerinds Podcast at amerindspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amerindspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.